Over the last several episodes, we've noted how the churches in the eastern and western halves of the Roman Empire were moving in different directions. By the end of the 6th century, that movement had coalesced into two different traditions. While the West remained loyal to the pattern held at Rome, the East emerged in three directions. The major councils held at Ephesus and Chalcedon to decide the issue that had been raised by the debate over the nature of Christ, that produced a three-way split in the Eastern Church. That split continues to this day and is seen in what's called the Chalcedonian or Byzantine Orthodox Church, which will eventually become the Eastern Orthodox Church of today. Second, the Nestorian Church of the East, and third, the Monophysite Church, seen primarily today in the Egyptian Coptic Church and the Ethiopian and Syrian Orthodox churches. In all fairness, I ought to mention that these churches reject the label Monophysite because they believe that it mischaracterizes their Christology. They prefer the term Miaphysite, which is their belief in a single, unified nature of Christ that is both human and divine, rather than a single nature that is only divine, which is what the label Monophysite suggests. Now, without going into all the details of the debates, suffice it to say that the Eastern Church wasn't satisfied with the Western-inspired formula describing the nature of Jesus adopted at the Council of Chalcedon in 451. In a scenario reminiscent of what had happened all the way back at the First Council in Nicaea a century before, while they concluded the Council at Chalcedon with an agreed creed, now some bishops later hemmed and hawed over the verbiage. To those Eastern bishops beholden to Cyril, Chalcedon sounded too Nestorian. You may remember that Chalcedon said that Jesus was, quote, one person in two natures, unquote. The balking bishops wanted to alter that to say that he was, quote, out of two natures, unquote, before the incarnation, but that afterwards he was a single nature. The Eastern pushback on Chalcedon wasn't just theological, it was also nationalistic. The church in Egypt went into revolt after the council because their patriarch, Dioscoros, was deposed. And then, as we've seen in Canon 28 of the Council's Creed, Constantinople was elevated as second to Rome in terms of prestige. So both Alexandria and Antioch got their togas in a bunch. Those bishops who supported the canons of Chalcedon were labeled Melkites, meaning royalists, because they supported the imperial church at Constantinople. Have you ever noticed how we Christians love putting labels on things, on people, you know, doctrines, heresies, and we're really good at it? We come up with some great terms, don't we? Well, the Western emperor was out of the picture by this time, so that the Roman Pope stood as a kind of lone figure leading the West. The Eastern emperors at Constantinople still wielded tremendous authority in the church. We might wonder, therefore, why they didn't step in to settle the issue about the nature of Christ. Well, I have to say they wanted to. Several of them would have liked to repudiate Chalcedon, but their hands were tied because there was one part of the council that they wanted to keep, and that was Canon 28 that made Constantinople technically Rome's second, but in reality her equal. As I studied the material that follows the debates between the aberrant Monophysites and the Orthodox Chalcedonians, I have to say that I found myself at a loss on how to relate it without boring the bejeebers out of you. I spent quite a bit of time working and then editing and re-editing, deleting, restoring, and deleting again before deciding to just say that in the East, during the 5th and 6th centuries, just about everybody was caught up in this thing, in this debate. Emperors, bishops, patriarchs, metropolitans, monks, priests, even the common people. There are technical words like encyclion, henoticon, severin, occasion, that are employed to define the different sides taken in the debate and the few who tried to forge a compromise. And let me tell you, those guys, they got hammered from both sides. Regarding the long debate over the nature of Christ in the East, historian of early Christianity Everett Ferguson says that the irony is that the Chalcedonians, Monophysites, and the Church of the East were really trying to say the same thing about Jesus. He was somehow, at the same time, two somethings but a single individual. Their different starting points gave different formulations that their opponents couldn't accept for theological reasons and wouldn't for political reasons. Politics. A sure way to make theology end up in the wrong place. Now, switching gears. Around the turn of the 5th to the 6th century, one of the most influential thinkers in Greek Orthodox spirituality made his mark. His name is Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite. and I say his name is because his real name is unknown. He claimed to be Dionysus, one of the Apostle Paul's Athenian converts mentioned in Acts chapter 17. For years, his writings were accepted as having been penned by a first century Dionysus. We now know they weren't. Pseudo-Dionysus combined Christianity and Neoplatonism into a kind of mishmash, slapdash theology that appealed to both Chalcedonians and Monophysites. Probably because when you read it inwardly, you say, "What?" But you have to nod your head saying how amazing it was so that you wouldn't appear stupid. Like when I read or listen to Stephen Hawking waxing eloquent on some tangent of astrophysics, I say, "Wow, that guy's brilliant." But don't ask me to explain what I just read or just heard. Yeah, he's speaking English, but it might as well be ancient Akkadian. I have no idea what he's talking about. Besides being a Neoplatonist, Pseudo-Dionysus was a mystic, someone who claimed to have had an experience of union with God, and not just a deep sense of connection to him, but an actual uniting with the essence of deity. Pseudo-Dionysus became the author of a branch of Christian mysticism that was hugely influential in Eastern Christianity. When his work was translated into Latin in the 9th century, he became influential in the West as well. Now, I want to give you a quote from Pseudo-Dionysus so you get an idea of what we're talking about. Here we go. Quote, "The one is a unity, which is the unifying source of all unity and a super essential essence, a mind beyond the reach of mind and a word beyond utterance, eluding discourse, intuition, name, and every kind of being. It is the universal cause of existence, while itself existing not, for it is beyond all being and such that it alone could give a revelation of itself." Unquote. What? That reminds me of a radio program I heard many years ago. I was headed home from work late one Sunday night. The drive took about a half an hour of freeway driving, and so I turned on the radio to my favorite station. And instead of the usual music, it was some Eastern guru talking about enlightenment. The expected Indian accent pronouncing English words, each of which I knew the definition of, but collectively arranged in such a way as to make no sense whatever. None. It was just a wall of words that after several minutes almost hypnotized me. And I realized what was happening and so made an effort to really listen and search for the meaning of what was being said. There wasn't any. There was no coherent message being communicated, simply a voice that aimed to move people into an altered state of consciousness that would make them highly susceptible to being manipulated. It's hard reading Pseudo-Dionysus and not seeing what he did much the same. When people want to appear smart and seem enlightened, it's easy to pretend that you find something that's esoteric easy. It's complex, but you find it transparent. I suspect that's what happened with people who read his writings. They, in fact, did not understand what was being said, because it's not really understandable that way. What it is, it's deeply affecting of the psyche. People feel profundity listening to Pseudo-Dionysus' wall of words. They express awe. That then encourages others to say that they feel it too. And soon all agree that Pseudo-Dionysus is on everybody's reading list, Oprah's book club, and the New York Times bestseller list. Pseudo-Dionysus' writings stressed a tendency that was already found in Greek Christian authors like Origen, Athanasius, Gregory of Nyssa, who said that the goal of our salvation was a kind of making humans divine. I need to be careful here because as soon as I say that, Western Christians say, "Wait, what? Back the truck up, Billy Bob. I think we just ran over something." Yeah, there is in Eastern Orthodoxy a different understanding of salvation from that of Roman Catholicism and classic Protestantism. Eastern Orthodoxy understands that the saved are destined to a level of glory in heaven that is on an order of existence that can only be properly described as divine. Now, humans do not become gods, not like the one true and only Creator God, but they were created in His image and will be restored to and completed in that image so that they will be as much like God as a created being can be and still not be God. This quasi-deification is attained by purification, illumination, and perfection, meaning union with God, which became the three stages of enlightenment espoused by classic mysticism. Okay, hang with me as we go deep here. Pseudo-Dionysus identified three stages in how someone seeking the fullness of salvation can describe God. Number one, giving him a name was affirmative theology. Number two, denying that name is negative theology. And then, number three, reconciling the contradiction by looking beyond language was superlative theology. The way of negation led to the contemplation that marks mystical theology, which was considered a simpler and purer way to understand God. In other words, it's easier to know who and what God is by concentrating on what he is not. And if that seems backward and nonsensical, welcome to the club of those who aren't mystics. Just scratch their heads when the mystics start talking. Pseudo-Dionysius' arrangement of angels into nine levels, well, that became the basis of the medieval doctrine of angels. His works were widely read and commented on by medieval theologians, including Thomas Aquinas, who will have such a huge impact on Roman Catholicism in our future episodes. Now, as I said, reading Pseudo-Dionysius can be frustrating for those who try to parse out his logic and seek to discern in his words some profound truths. While all very spiritual sounding, they're typical of much of mystical tomes, a cascade of words that defy interpreting. The mind is set in a place of trying to reconcile competing and ultimately contradictory ideas. This tension causes the reader to mentally shut down, and it's in that state of suspended reason that the soul is supposed to be able to connect to God. It has the same effect as repeated mantras and Eastern-style meditation. Still, Pseudo-Dionysius was extremely influential in shaping how countless Christians of the 6th through the 10th centuries went about seeking to grow in their relationship with God. Today, we dismiss him by calling him pseudo, fake, fraud, poser Dionysius. Now, I want to tie the bow on our look at Pseudo-Dionysius by saying that this review may leave the impression that the stream of Christian devotional writings called mystic isn't to be rejected out of hand. Some of the greatest writings in church history have come from this genre of discipleship. Brother Lawrence's Practicing the Presence of God, Thomas A. Kempis's The Imitation of Christ, they're classics. The popular modern author A.W. Tozer was regarded by many as a modern mystic. We turn now to one of the truly great names in church history, so much so it's in his title, Gregory the Great. As we've seen, with the fall of the Roman imperial system in the West, the church played an ever-increasing role in society. The form that influence took varied over the centuries, sometimes being more religious and spiritual in nature, and at other times being predominantly political. But there's no denying that in Europe during the Middle Ages, the church played a major, and maybe the major, role. Historian Rodney Stark makes a distinction between the church of power and the church of piety in the Middle Ages of Europe. The church of power, that was the domain of popes, cardinals, bishops, who as often as not obtained their office not by spiritual merit, but by nepotism, political cunning, or avarice. Simony, which is the buying and selling of religious offices, was commonplace. The church of piety, well, that was staffed by parish priests, monks, and nuns who genuinely wanted to seek God and the benefit of their communities by serving Christ. It was from this church of piety that the theological work of the Middle Ages came, and some good work it was too. During the 5th and the early 6th centuries, as civil society disintegrated, people, well, they needed alternatives, and some found an answer in monastic communities. There had been communes of Christians since the 3rd century, but the number of monasteries began to grow during the 5th. Some were highly structured, while others were more loosely organized. As we've seen, the monastic movement really took off with the leadership of Benedict of Nursia. Benedict's early attempts at being the leader or abbot of a monastery, you may remember, they didn't go so well. Monks tried to poison him. But as he matured, Benedict applied the lessons learned from his previous mistakes and failures, founded a monastery on Monte Cassino in Italy that became, well, really the prototypical monastery for centuries to come. Benedict was simply a genius for administration and organization. He formulated a simple plan for monastic living that was easily transferred to other communes. Known as the Rule of Saint Benedict, it became the organizing and governing principle for monastic life, and under it, hundreds more monasteries were begun. The rule held forth a daily routine of Bible reading, prayer, and work. Benedict's sister, Scholastica, adopted a similar formula for convent and their women monks, called, of course, nuns. Monasteries became repositories and treasuries of the learning and scholarship of Greece and Rome, as the rest of Europe plunged into what some refer to as the Dark Ages, but weren't, as we'll see. Many monasteries remained places of scholarship. The monks read, studied, and spent considerable time copying ancient texts of both scripture and classical antiquity. The Renaissance would eventually be fed by the work of these monks and their hundreds of years of work. What we know about Benedict comes from his biographer, Gregory, known to us as Pope Gregory I, or Gregory the Great, a title conferred on him by the church shortly after his death. Gregory was born into a wealthy and ancient Roman senatorial family around 540. Following family tradition, he was trained for civil service. But the political landscape was uncertain. During his childhood, the rule of Rome passed through several different regimes. While only in his mid-teens, control of southern Italy was wrested from the Visigoths by the reconquest of the Eastern Emperor Justinian the Great. But it was only a few years till the Lombards began their campaign of terror. They burned churches, murdered bishops, plundered monasteries, and turned the verdant fields of Italy into weed-strewn wilderness. When he was 33, Justinian appointed Gregory as the prefect of Rome, the highest political position in the territory. Gregory became responsible for the economy, food provisions, welfare of the poor, reconstruction of the now ancient and badly decayed infrastructure, you know, things like baths and sewers and streets. His appointment came in the same year that both the Pope and the imperial governor of Italy died. A few years later, Gregory resigned his office. Now, I'm sure you know that it's rare when someone who wields great power just walks away from it. But that's what Gregory did. The death of his father seemed to be the turning point. And one wonders if it wasn't his father's dreams for his son that had moved Gregory into a political career to begin with. But once the father was gone, there was nothing holding him to his position, and Gregory followed his heart, which was to become a monk. With his considerable fortune, he founded 7 monasteries and gave what was left to the poor. He then turned his family home into a monastery. As Bruce Shelley puts it, quote, he exchanged the purple toga for the coarse robe of a monk, unquote. He embraced the austere life of a monk with full devotion to the rule of Saint Benedict. As much as Gregory desired to dissolve into obscurity and live a life of just humble devotion to God, his outstanding gifts as an administrator had fixed him a reputation that he was unable to dodge. In 579, Pope Pelagius II made him one of the 7 deacons for the church at Rome. He was then sent as an ambassador for the Pope to the imperial court in Constantinople. He returned to Rome in 585 and was appointed abbot of the convent that had once been his house. Gregory was quite content to remain an abbot and would aspire to no higher office. Happy, you know, really to just finish his sojourn on earth right there. But the plague swept through Rome, killing thousands, including the Pope. Unlike most monks who hid behind their commune's walls, Gregory went into the city to help the sick. And this earned him a great admiration. After Pope Pelagius died, it took church leaders just 6 months to settle on Gregory to replace him. He balked. He fled Rome to hide in the countryside. When he was eventually located, they persuaded him to return and take up the bishop's seat. Gregory seemed ill-suited to the task. He was 50 and frail. Now, 50 would be young for a pope today, but when the average lifespan was a mere 40 years, 50 was already an advanced age. Gregory's physical condition had been made worse by his extreme austerity as a monk. Drastic fasting had enfeebled him and contributed to the weakening of his heart. But what some might assume his main disqualification was Gregory's lack of ambition for power. He simply did not want to be pope. Coming to the belief that it was God's will that he take up the task, it didn't take him long to learn how to wield the influence of his office. He began his term by calling for public demonstrations of humility from what was left of Rome's plague-decimated populace. His hope was to avert more disaster, and indeed, the plague ebbed. Gregory hadn't been pope long when the Lombards laid siege to Rome. This was a time of chaos throughout Western Europe. Many otherwise cool heads thought that it was the end times, and Gregory was one of them. In a sermon, he said this, quote, "Everywhere we see tribulation, everywhere we hear lamentation. The cities are destroyed, the castles torn down, the fields laid waste, the land made desolate. Villages are empty, few inhabitants remain in the cities, and even these poor remnants of humanity are daily cut down. The scourge of celestial justice does not cease because no repentance takes place under the scourge. We see how some are carried into captivity, others mutilated, others slain. What is it, brethren, that can make us contented with this life? If we love such a world, we love not our joys, but our wounds, unquote. It seemed that every aspect of civilization was being shaken to ruins. The church at Rome was one of a few that survived the ordeals that came like hammer blows at this time. Though Gregory saw his promotion to the papacy as punishment, he surrendered himself wholeheartedly to the task of keeping things together while everything else was falling apart. Pope Gregory I was a tireless leader. He accomplished the work of 10. His volume of work is all the more remarkable in that he was often confined to bed because of sickness brought on by his frailty and overwork. Seeing himself as genuinely the first among equals with other bishops, he produced a vast volume of correspondence, making sure that the lines of communication between the churches kept everyone abreast of church affairs. That alone would have been a full-time pursuit. Gregory did more, much more. He knew from both his time as a monk and in watching his brothers in the monastery that the quality of one's work for God is directly proportional to the heart's devotion to him. So in his book, Pastoral Care, Gregory reminded spiritual leaders to never be so preoccupied with work that they forgot their own souls. But there was a much needed counterpoint to that. They must also not become so internally focused that they neglected practical work. This was a point of balance rarely glimpsed in the Christianity of that age. Gregory was also concerned for the quality of worship in the church and encouraged the use of music. Though he did not invent what is called plain song or plain chant, he greatly encouraged its use. In honor of his patronage of this form of worship, we know it as Gregorian chant. Now, plain song is a single melodic line without instrumental accompaniment. While a single singer may sing, it was usually sung by a chorus of voices in unison. Gregory took seriously his call to be the standard bearer of the faith. His contribution to theology was quite remarkable. He wrote more on theology than any previous and most subsequent popes. His main influences were Augustine, Ambrose, and Jerome. He leaned heavily on Augustine's work, even at times drawing inspiration from casual comments that he had made. You may remember back several episodes too when we noted how the church believed that baptism washed away all sins up to that point. Well, what happened to those sins committed after baptism? You know, ones not confessed before death and had not been expiated by penance. Now, Augustine had mused on how God might, maybe, possibly, remove these sins after believers died. And it was from this speculative musing that Gregory developed the idea that God purged them in a purgatory. And so the doctrine of purgatory was added to church doctrine. Gregory's theology encapsulated not only the creeds of the councils and teachings of the fathers, but also included some of the superstitious accretions of a Christianized paganism. To illustrate that, I pose this question. How do we get from the picture of Christian fellowship and the kind of church service that we find in the New Testament and the earliest descriptions of them to the elaborate, formal, highly structured, and stylized services of the medieval and later church? There's an obvious discontinuity between them. When did pastors begin wearing elaborate robes and headgear and start carrying gilded and bejeweled crosiers? To put it bluntly, whence all the complex ritual and lavish accoutrements? I don't think anyone imagines Jesus conducting such a service, or even Peter. So it's a legitimate question to ask when these things were adopted and became a part of church liturgy. The answer is, as the Western Roman Empire folded and church leaders became increasingly looked to provide governance, they also began to affect some of the trappings of political office. As Christianity became the favored and then the approved religion of the empire, an all-too-common syncretism began to blend pagan and Christian practices. All Gregory did was standardize this syncretistic blend and bequeath it to the Church of the Middle Ages. He endorsed an earlier practice of appealing to past martyrs and saints for help in securing God's aid. The idea was that a penitent sinner could never really know if he or she had done enough penance to atone for sin. By appealing for help to those believers who died and gone to heaven, they might be able, through their special standing with God, find assistance in having their sins discharged. It kind of like spiritual brokers who negotiated a better deal for the earthbound. Gregory encouraged the collection and veneration of relics. Strands of hair, fingernails, toe bones, pieces of clothing from past saints and martyrs, as well as paraphernalia supposedly connected to Bible stories. You know, pieces of the cross, the spear that pierced Jesus' side, a towel that was used to wipe Christ's brow. It was assumed these relics possessed spiritual power to heal and give the armies that venerated them favor in battle. Gregory taught that the body and blood of Christ were really present in the elements of communion, the bread and the wine. He claimed that partaking of them nourished and strengthened one's spirit, just as literal bread and wine nourished the physical body. But Gregory took it further. The real power of the communion elements, the Eucharist, was in its renewing of the sacrifice of Christ's death. The Eucharist didn't just remember Jesus' substitutionary atonement, it was a fresh enactment of it. During communion, in the Mass offered by a priest, sins were forgiven. What Jesus did on the cross did potentially for all people. The Mass applied to specific people who partook of it. So celebrating the Mass replaced the need for some forms of penance. Certain sins required both attending Mass and penance. But for the average, you know, run-of-the-mill kind of sins, Mass replaced penance. And then people reasoned, hey, if dead saints could assist them by intercession with God, why couldn't living believers attend extra Masses for departed loved ones to lessen their time in purgatory? Light a candle, say a prayer, attend an extra Mass, and you might shorten Uncle Giacomo's sentence by a week. This theological base, fashioned by Gregory, would be used hundreds of years later to sell indulgences. And Johann Tetzel's clever fundraising ditty, "When in the offering box the coin rings, another soul from purgatory springs." Gregory's realm of oversight wasn't limited to the spiritual affairs of the church. During his tenure, the church owned huge tracts of land in southern Italy and Sicily, some 1,800 square miles in all. When the Lombards invaded, sweeping away the last vestiges of civil authority, it was church leaders and their representatives who had to step in to provide governance. They took over the infrastructure of providing food and the necessary collection of taxes to maintain at least some semblance of civil affairs. Some historians and armchair critics lament the blurring of the line between church and state. But they fail to realize, had it not been for church officials stepping in following the Lombards' incursions, thousands would have perished. Gregory was the one who set up and oversaw this new tax and public assistance system. As the Lombards drew closer to Rome, Gregory took charge of the defense of central Italy. He appointed the military governor and arranged a treaty with the enemy leaders. So think of this now. Gregory was trained from youth for political office and had served well in that capacity until his father's death, when he then resigned to seek the quiet life of a monk. When the plague gutted both church and state of capable leaders, Gregory was drafted to take the reins of the church and ended up back in the civil sphere by sheer necessity. The Lombards hammered the last nails in the coffin of Roman civil government, requiring for the sake of public welfare that Gregory mobilize the leadership of the church to step up and follow his lead of taking on the task of civil authority. Though Gregory greatly expanded papal influence so that from his day on, the Pope was a central figure in European politics, the motive for all that he did is seen in his simple concern for the welfare of the needy. The tension between Eastern and Western churches that had begun over 100 years before as Rome and Constantinople vied for supremacy, it grew during Gregory's term. But not because of Gregory's personal ambition for power. His criticism of the Eastern Patriarch was due to his belief in Rome's primacy and his resistance to the kind of, well, pride that was on full display in the East. The Eastern Patriarch, John IV, had taken the title of Universal Bishop, an honorific that was granted the Patriarch by the Eastern Emperor. The title was confirmed in an Eastern Synod in 588. Gregory considered that title a usurpation of Rome's primacy and arrogance that God would not allow. He did all that he could to have the title revoked and called down mighty anathemas on John. He threatened to break off all connection with the patriarch and demanded that the emperor rescind the title. When someone applied the same title to him, Gregory's reaction was immediate and vehement. No one was to be called the universal pope. He said, quote, "I have said that neither to me nor to anyone else ought you to write anything of the kind. Away with words which inflate pride and wound charity," unquote. He preferred to be known as simply servant of the servants of God. What appears a contradiction to historians is that while Gregory eschewed such pretentious titles, he claimed and exercised authority over the entire church. While in his case, that oversight was due to his scrupulous sense of duty to serve God by serving his people, well, later popes would accept the grand titles and use the power of the papacy to less altruistic ends. Gregory is an important name in the list of popes because it was under his term that a great wave of missionary outreach began. If Leo the Great had sought to expand the power and influence of the office of the Pope, Gregory the Great expanded the influence of the gospel to new lands beyond the borders of the empire. Being the first monk to become a pope, Gregory realized monasteries were like spiritual barracks that could send out an army of evangelists. If Rome couldn't field military legions to repel the barbarians, why not send out legions of missionaries to convert those barbarians and then appeal to their faith to forestall attack? Convert warlike barbarians into daring, peace-loving, and then peace-spreading missionaries who, instead of invading Europe, would carry the cross north and east. Good plan, and Gregory implemented it pretty well. As a youngster, Gregory had watched as slave ships were unloaded at the docks. The slaves were Angles from Angleland, which morphs into England. The name Angle sounded like angel to the young Gregory and set within him the idea that where these barbarians came from needed the gospel. And besides his interest in missions to Britain, Gregory also promoted missionary activity among the Germanic tribes. But it wasn't until about 100 years after his time that missionary work among the Germanic tribes would, well, really take off. We're going to end this episode with a question that anyone who dives into church history is bound to get around to. And it is this: when did the Western Church, centered in Rome under the overall leadership of the Roman bishop, who's come to be known as the Pope, when did it really become what today we know as Roman Catholic? There was no one day that the church transitioned from being the apostolic church into the Roman Catholic Church. It was a slow, steady series of events that saw the Roman bishop be looked at as the mostly undisputed leader of the Western Church. And I say mostly undisputed because while the Eastern Church centered in Constantinople, Antioch, and Alexandria honored Rome's bishop as a first among equals, there were always a handful of Western bishops who esteemed the lead pastor at Rome in much the same way. They did not see their role as the bishop of their city in any way under a Roman pope's authority. And don't forget that for many centuries, the term Catholic simply means universal. It carried none of the denominational freight that it does today. The word simply meant the faith that followed the creeds set out by the ecumenical councils, those gatherings attended by a cross-section of church leaders so that they could define a biblically faithful position on doctrines that were being mucked up by the heretics. An ultra-simple definition, then, of Roman Catholicism is that branch of the Christian faith that embodies the early creeds of the church as it coalesced in Europe, led by the church at and the bishop of Rome. As the generations passed, Roman Catholicism will take on a much additional doctrine to that embodied in the early creeds. That doctrine was most often decided by the Roman bishop, whose power and authority grew so that he replaced the councils. So while it's difficult to name a, well, date when Roman Catholicism became, you know, Roman Catholic, many church historians suggest that it was Gregory's appointment as the bishop of Rome in 590. Well, that's as good a place as any to drive that stake into the church history timeline. Though Gregory refused the title pope, he did set up the system of church government that framed the entire medieval period and is today called the papal system. Gregory set a uniform liturgy to be used in the churches and did much to ensure that all of the churches walked lockstep with Rome. When he died in 604, worn out after 30 years of hard work, his epitaph proclaimed him God's consul, an appropriate description of the man who'd spent his entire life and career wholly in God's service, but wielding both secular and spiritual power like one of the ancient Roman rulers.